Hi, welcome to the Al Franken podcast. We've got a really good one for a change. It's Howard Fineman, who younger folks listening may know only from MSNBC. He's the guy who looks like an older, grayer Max Weinberg, Bruce Springsteen's drummer. Howard has had a 45-year career thus far as a journalist. For years, he wrote the political cover stories for Newsweek, and Howard was one of those guys like David Broder who would travel all over the country, and he'd ride the bus with the other reporters, and he'd talk with locals as part of his story. So Howard knows this country very well, but a part of the country he knows probably better than any other Beltway journalist is Kentucky, because Howard's first job as a reporter was for the Louisville Courier-Journal. So Howard knows Kentucky, and he's covered Mitch McConnell for decades, and I thought it was time for a podcast to help my listeners understand how cynical and power-hungry and just awful the current majority leader is. And so Howard and I sat down this past Thursday and recorded our conversation, but Mitch is so awful that while we were discussing how he is destroying our institutions and our democracy, he did another wretched thing. What McConnell did was put a hold on the Securing American Federal Elections Act. Now, this is a bill that had been passed by the House that would direct $600 million in election assistance to the states and require backup paper ballots so the results can't be hacked and you can do a recount that you can rely on. Now, I'm going to quote from the Washington Post's Dana Milbank. Quote, McConnell himself responded this time, reading from a statement, his chin melting into his chest, his trademark thin smile on his lips. It's just a highly partisan bill from the same folks who spent 2 years hyping up a conspiracy theory about President Trump and Russia, he said. Therefore, I object. Now, I thought the thing about the chin melting into the chest was entirely unnecessary, frankly, except that we here at the Al Franken podcast have learned that during the August recess, McConnell is finally getting some work done. And when he comes back, that whole turtle thing will be history, and he will have the tight jawline and neck of a college freshman. It's gonna take some time getting used to, frankly. Look, a lot of people have been saying the Russians are going to be back. Believe me, they've never left. McConnell put a hold on this election security bill the day after Mueller told the American people that the Russians are going to do everything they can to hack us and interfere with the 2020 election. And also, let's remember that the president said just recently that if a foreign power offers him help in the next election, that he'll accept it. Republicans don't want fair elections. We all know that. They try to make it as hard as possible for certain people to vote. When they gerrymander, they stuff as many Democrats as they can into a congressional district so it's 90% Democratic, so Republicans can have all these safe 60-40 districts around the state. From election to election, they change the location of the polling places in certain neighborhoods. They reduce the number of polling places. That makes for longer lines. They want to make it much harder for certain people to vote. So securing our elections is now a partisan issue. And Mitch McConnell stopped a bill that would prevent foreign countries from hacking our elections. A bill that would require paper ballots so that we'll have a physical record of every vote. So Mitch got the nickname Moscow Mitch right after Howard and I finished our conversation. So in the next 50 minutes or so, you're going to learn some fun stuff about Mitch McConnell from Howard Fineman, who began his distinguished career in Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, this is Harold Fineman of the Courier-Journal in Louisville. I'm here broadcasting from 6th and Broadway in downtown Louisville across the state of Kentucky, from Pikeville to Paducah.
Now, Howard,
yes.
Explain yourself.
So, Al, when I first went down to Kentucky, I began to realize that Howard is not a very common name there, but Harold is an incredibly common name. So when I would call up public officials to interview them, they would inevitably call me Harold. And there was one guy in particular over in the Department of Energy in Kentucky. I'd call him up and I'd say, "Hey, Mr. Stapleton, it's Howard Fineman from the Courier-Journal." And he'd say, "Hey, Harold, how you doing?" And I would say, "I'm fine, sir, but it's Howard." And he'd say, "Right, Harold. Now, what was you calling about?" And also my byline in the paper read Howard Fineman. And just as there are not many Howards, there weren't many Finemans. There were a couple.
Really?
There weren't many. And most people read that as Fineman. So basically, I went through my nearly 5 years in Kentucky as Harold Fineman. And as a matter of fact, that's how I'd like to be known on this episode of the Al Franken podcast, and say it in case I say something that I need to deny.
Hi, everybody. You are in for a treat today. Howard Fineman is my guest, and here's the treat. We're not going to be talking about Howard Fineman. We're going to spend the next...
Well, that's it for me, Al. I'm sorry. I'm out of here.
We're going to spend the next minutes talking about Mitch McConnell. All right. Mitch McConnell. Let's get this out of the way. We're friends.
Yes.
Yes. I think I have to disclose that. And we met in, I think it was December or late November 1987.
Late 1987 on the way to Iowa.
We were flying to Des Moines because of, there was a debate, a Democratic primary debate in Iowa. And this was my first one-man uplink unit, the thing where I wore the satellite dish
right
on my head. And
which is an idea that I claim I had first, but I didn't have a TV show to put it on, so there you go.
Yeah. Fuck you. Okay. Spence with that wittily. So anyway, and I knew that there'd be all, there's this place in the parking lot where they have all the trucks.
Yes.
And so I knew there'd be a lot of satellite dishes there.
Yes.
And I thought that'd be
yes.
a fun backdrop.
What I liked was that you had a real desire and intuitive sense of how to evaluate what was going on in politics. I feel that I was there, present at the creation of what turned out to be a great political career. So,
well, thanks.
You're welcome.
And you have a decent sense of humor.
Well, one of the problems of our relationship is I'm always trying to be funny in front of you, which is
it's
difficult and a big mistake.
Big mistake.
Because it's an amateur playing in a professional league.
I mean, you discovered that I had a fairly deep understanding of politics, and I discovered that you had a deep understanding of politics as well. But that didn't surprise me.
Okay.
Also, I discovered that Howard has a fabulous sense of humor. You are selling yourself short. And by that, I mean you laugh easily. That's what...
number one rule is to laugh at whatever Al says.
Yes, that's the only thing comedians care about. So, Mitch McConnell, your first beat.
Yep.
Was Louisville.
Right.
And it is Louisville.
Yes, it is. It is Louisville. And the way you say it, if you're from Louisville, is to collapse it all into one melted syllable, Louisville.
So Louisville. And so you go long, you go back to what year with Mitch McConnell? Covering Mitch McConnell.
Really, it's possible that I met Mitch McConnell when I first started out in Louisville in the fall of 73, and Mitch, who was then a lawyer in private practice, was in Louisville, was in the process of taking over the rather defunct Republican Party of Jefferson County, which Louisville is in. If I didn't meet him right away, I pretty soon after that began to know who he was because he got involved in local politics, and I covered a little bit of local politics from the beginning, not much. That was a prestige beat that I didn't have the seniority or the knowledge to be on exactly.
And when did you guys, like, then when was he aware of
Well, we really didn't get to know each other until I was already at Newsweek magazine
a number
of years later, and he had been elected to the Senate. And naturally enough, I wanted to keep in close touch with members of the Senate from Kentucky and House members from Kentucky.
So you have a long-standing journalist politician relationship,
yes.
And you can't help but love the guy, right?
Well, I have an interesting attitude towards Mitch, which I still haven't entirely, in every molecule of my body, given up, which is that he started out as a moderate and even liberal Republican who was pro-civil rights and pro-abortion.
I kind of think I know where this is going, and I would give up that molecule.
Well, and also he'd had polio as a child and is something of a loner, and I persist in thinking that...
And you'd think that would give you a lot of, you know,
yes.
feeling and sympathy, and you would but care he, about people.
But he's done everything he can in his public role as a politician to drive away anybody's desire to view him sympathetically as a person. He actually makes it very difficult for anybody to like him personally, even people who deal with him all the time and who are on the same page politically with him now, whatever page he happens to be on at this point.
So you're saying even people in the caucus.
Yeah, even people in the caucus. I mean, they respect him. They fear him. They understand his keen strategic sense and his big brain for the mechanics of politics. But would they all like to spend a lot of time with him personally or any time with him personally? I don't really think so. And so as a reporter, I try to see the humanity in everybody I cover because I think that's the way you view your fellow man and the best way to cover politics. But Mitch makes it awfully hard. He makes it awfully hard.
I'll give you an example of what makes it hard. This week, these coal miners with black lung, which kills you, you die.
Which is from breathing coal dust in the mines.
Right.
Yeah.
Came to Capitol Hill, and Kentucky, of course, is a big coal state. He came into the room where they were and sounds like less than a minute.
Well, that's a good example of his public willingness to play the utterly unsympathetic defender of corporate interests. He's proud of that. I would say that Mitch McConnell is undoubtedly proud of the fact that he did what he did yesterday. He's telling himself, these people are never going to support me. They're trying to show me up by doing this caravan trip to Washington. They're lucky to be getting anything by way of a federal tax to replenish the black lung
fund.
There
is a fee that the coal companies pay
per ton.
And they've halved it. It's been halved.
Yes, it was $1.10 a ton. Now it's down to 55 cents. They literally chopped it in half. And I'm sure McConnell is utterly unapologetic about that. And what's interesting...
And they want it just to be restored.
Yeah, they want it to be restored back to where it was. And the... By the way, under great pressure from your buddy and mine, John Stewart, the Senate voted and McConnell supported replenishing that fund.
The 9/11.
The 9/11 fund for 70 years, making it whole for 70 years under the actuarial expectations. And he won't do the same thing, anything like something akin to that in his own state, where he's always arguing when he runs for reelection that isn't it great that Kentucky has such a important and powerful guy in the Senate. With all this seniority, with all this power, he can do all these great things for Kentucky. Well, there's an example of him just basically spitting in their eye.
Well, it depends who you consider Kentucky, because if somebody owns those coal mines, and they're probably from Kentucky.
Maybe.
Some of them.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
Not necessarily.
But those people he's courted
Sure he has.
He's, forever, right?
Yeah, yeah, when he first ran for the Senate in 1984, after two terms as the chief executive of Jefferson County, that was a time, and I'd not left there that long before, and I knew it because I covered it, the coal industry was undoubtedly the most powerful political force in the state. The electric utilities were in concert with them, and they burned all the coal for the electricity in the state. But the utilities were regulated by the state Public Service Commission, and they were a little more cautious politically. The Coal Operators Association, the KOA, was way out front, way intimidating in their politics, way eager to play the bad guy. They didn't care. That was the way they thought they would control the, you know, obstreperous miners and so forth. And Mitch McConnell from Louisville, where it was hard to get elected statewide, did whatever he could to play up to them, and he's done it ever since. I mean, he's proudly in the pocket of the coal industry.
The operator, the owners.
The owners. He's proudly in the pocket. And the miners at that time, and still in Kentucky, are mostly union. They're mostly members of the United Mine Workers. And Mitch is the sworn enemy of unions. Even though he began his career when he first ran for county executive with the endorsement, he sought and got the endorsement of the AFL-CIO Council in Louisville and then promptly ignored the fact that he'd done so as soon as he got elected.
Not only did he ignore it, I read this book, The Cynic, mm-hmm. about him. Not only did he ignore them, he actually said that, yeah, I said I was pro-union, but I didn't mean it, but I just did it to get the AFL-CIO's endorsement.
Yes, and that is another signature part of the public persona of Mitch McConnell. He proudly advertises his political cynicism. He's proud of it because he's told himself it's for a higher purpose of rolling back the role of government in our lives. I think that's how he justifies it. His favorite philosopher, I don't know how much philosophy he actually reads, is Edmund Burke. And he considers himself, when he's trying to claim an intellectual gloss for what he's doing, yeah. as this principled conservative. But really what he's always been for is power, and strictly for, in a way that I haven't seen in any other politician that I've covered in the Senate.
Well, he admits, like, oh,
he's proud of it.
The Edmund Burke thing is that's not true. I just say it.
This is just a... God. Get dummies like Howard Feynman to go read Edmund Burke. But he's naked about it. And in that sense, he was Trump before Trump was Trump. Because one of the keys to both of them is their utter shameless pride in their cynicism and their power manipulation. And what gives it a twist with Mitch McConnell is that he claims to adore and revere institutions like the Republican Party.
That's the Burkean part of him. Yeah, but that's not true.
No. Not only is it not true, Al, he has done everything he can to destroy the independent power of those institutions and gather that power in his own hands. He's basically, if not being the major cause of ruining the Senate as we used to know it, he's done it and he's gathered the power in his own hands. As for the Republican Party, he became a willing ally of Donald Trump in destroying the independent power of the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell became the first and best of the modern fundraisers who made the money go through him. But unlike Lyndon Johnson, who did the same thing, Mitch didn't do it for the purpose of building up the Democratic Party at all. He did it only for himself.
On the Al Franken podcast, there's always a lot going on. Big ideas, tough questions, and sometimes a little comedy to lighten things up. But when it comes to caring for a senior loved one, things can feel just as overwhelming. Care.com can help with many needs, whether you're looking for in-home companionship or support for dementia care. You can find background-checked caregivers through Care.com or even browse senior living communities and read real reviews from families like yours. If you're not sure what's best, senior care advisors, who are all master's level social workers, can help you build a plan that fits your family. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. For a limited time, use the code POD20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's POD20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care search today. When it's not you, it's care.com.
We really should give some time to defending Mitch. So we should give some time to that. Okay, that's enough. So now, okay, so he...
Well, I maintain that molecule of hope, let's say that. I don't know why.
No, well...
I don't know why. I just don't know why.
Okay, school busing, because that's been in the news of late.
Yeah.
And I remember Louisville had a big school busing thing in 1974, and it wasn't popular. Is that right?
No, it was a federally court-ordered busing for integration plan. It was the same year as Boston, and that was also a federally court-ordered one. And in Louisville, it ordered the combination of the City of Louisville schools, which had been desegregated on their own the decade before, and which had almost all of the blacks living in that county of Jefferson County, and the county suburban schools, which were almost entirely lily white. And when that federal court order came in, it exploded the city. The powers that be at the newspaper I worked for, in government, tried to be responsible, tried to make it work, tried to make the combination work. It became one of the largest school districts in the country. But there was severe and sometimes violent protests against it in those suburbs. It essentially ruined the career of the chief executive of the county at that time. It didn't help the mayor that much either.
But the reason you bring up that county guy is that he ran against Mitch, right?
Yes. He was the incumbent in 1977, Mitch McConnell, realizing that the busing issue had severely damaged the incumbent, saw that he had an opening, and it was created by busing. But since he'd had a moderate background and since he wanted the support of the powers that be in the region, he was very shrewd about not directly using the busing issue in his campaign or in his advertising.
Yes, he didn't have to.
Even though he privately knew that he didn't have to because it had so weakened his opponent.
Well, yeah.
But as soon as he won, he made it clear that he was for an amendment to prevent federally court-ordered busing.
We obviously had this come up in the Democratic debates. Kamala Harris brought that up to criticize Biden for being for local. So she must be for federally mandated busing, I would think, then, right?
Well,
now. The problem still exists. I mean,
yes,
we are
it's even worse in some respects.
Yeah, so because we're still a lot segregated. Because
what happened in places like Louisville and elsewhere, especially in the South, the white people fled the public schools, and this is true all over the country, actually. In the South, they're called Christian academies. But all around the country, yes, white people have fled the public schools. So the situation in many respects is even worse. The problem is you can't have a court order.
On the Christian schools.
Yeah. But yes, in the debate of the other week, Kamala Harris seemed to be saying that she supported federally court-ordered busing as she criticized Joe Biden for not doing so and for saying that it could be a local initiative, but it can't be ordered from above by the federal courts.
But that's her position now. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not her position now. Her position now is, I really am not in favor of federal court-ordered busing either, and it should be a local concern.
I see. But that's what I meant. I mean, so her position now
is closer to where Biden was, if not identical with where Biden is.
She should have said that.
Well, let's see if that comes up in the next debate, because Joe Biden has said, no more Mr. Nice Guy. I'm going to fire back. I was not prepared for that last time. I will be this time. I would expect, I think the way the debate is set up for Detroit, the two nights of debates, I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are on the same night. So I would expect that subject to come up again.
Okay. So he runs for the Senate. Roger Ailes is his guy.
Yeah.
He does his ads. And Roger Ailes is on his way up in the Republican Party.
Well, yes.
So this is just nice guy.
Roger Ailes had not yet distinguished himself with the Willie Horton stuff and the race issue later on, which happened a few years later.
He's ramping up to that.
But in the case of Mitch McConnell's race in 84 in Kentucky, Ronald Reagan was a very popular president with Republicans and pretty popular overall. And Mitch was lucky to be running for Senate for the first time out of Louisville, which, as I said, hard to get elected statewide from Louisville. With Ronald Reagan at the top of the ticket. Ronald Reagan won Kentucky by about 235,000 votes. Mitch McConnell barely beat a colorless incumbent named Dee Huddleston from Western Kentucky, the Democrat. And their ad that Roger Ailes produced was the famous ad in which they harped on Huddleston's mediocre attendance and voting record. He didn't show up all the time to vote. And they had a bunch of bloodhounds pouring out of the back of a pickup truck searching for Dee Huddleston.
Bloodhounds looking for Dee Huddleston. It sounds like a real clever
ad. Well, that had the additional benefit for Mitch of making it seem like he knew what a bloodhound was, which I'm not sure that he did since he grew up in the suburbs of Louisville.
Okay, so he's in the Senate, and McCain-Feingold comes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember because when we did the Disclose Act later, after Citizens United, we wanted at least for disclosure,
yes,
which Kennedy, who wrote the opinion on Citizens United, had said, this will be great because everyone will know.
Yes. Yeah.
That was in the decision.
Yes, I know.
So we wanted to, the Democrats wanted to, have a thing where you disclose. And he had said during McCain-Feingold, he said that disclosure is the great disinfectant. That's what he said, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of them, like Orrin Hatch and those people who voted against McCain-Feingold, said similar things. Disclosure, 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 I remember one of them saying. Of course, we had 59 in the Senate at that time, Democrats, because Scott Brown had won the race. So we have to get every Democratic vote and one Republican, and we don't get it when we know we're not going to get it. So I'm sitting in the well. I memorize who said what. So, you know, Senator McConnell, and he's walking up to do his vote, and I go like, sunshine's the greatest disinfectant. And he just ignored me, of course. Every once in a while, someone would get irked that I was throwing that in their faces. And they'd say something like, well, this one treats unions differently than corporations. And I go, no, it doesn't. And they go, nay. And then, so at one point, a senator comes up and says maybe the stupidest thing, Republican senator, says maybe the stupidest thing I heard from any senator while I was there. And I say, I'm saying something to somebody about what he had said. And he goes like, well, you know, some people don't have to disclose. And I go, what do you mean? Like who? Who doesn't have to disclose if they give over $10,000? Well, let's say the New York Times runs an editorial. It doesn't have to disclose. And I said, it's in the New York Times. And he said, oh, nay.
Well, that was actually very stupid, but very revealing in the sense that he viewed, as they all did, places like the New York Times as purely political entities.
Yeah, they're saying that
it's like a pack.
Something.
Yeah.
But it's kind of disclosed.
Well, look, one of the consistent patterns of Mitch McConnell's career is that every time you think he can't be that cynical and disregarding of what he said or argued before, you're proved wrong, because he has something that is a gift for certain politicians, which that he was born without the DNA that creates the emotion of shame in the public mind. I mean, in his mind, he cannot be shamed into admitting that any of his hypocrisies or cynicisms
He's proud of him.
He's not only not ashamed of him, he's proud of him because he thinks he's doing it for a higher purpose. And what he's told himself is the importance of not letting the government run everything. And this is a powerful thing in Kentucky. I mean, I spent 5 years there. And, of course, the great paradox is that Kentucky is one of the places where more citizens rely on federal benefits than most places in the country.
Well, they must realize that.
No, they don't.
Kentuckians.
No, they don't. They don't realize it. They're not grateful because it goes against their view of themselves.
Right. Okay, so here's a really cynical thing he did. In 2006, and George W. Bush wrote about this in his memoir, no bigger supporter of the war in Iraq than Mitch McConnell, but he goes to the White House and he asks President Bush to draw down the troops before the 2006 election. So it looked like he's kind of moving to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush says something like, I'm going to have as many troops as I can to win the war, not to win the election.
Yeah.
People get killed because you draw down
Well, again, Mitch McConnell's only concern, for some reason, from a young age, he decided that what he wanted, his route to power and control of his circumstances, which I guess you could argue he felt as a polio victim or whatever he didn't have.
Right.
Is to be the majority leader of the Senate and run the Senate in the manner. He's never given any particular credit or nod to Lyndon Johnson, but you know, Robert Caro, the great journalist and biographer, has spent basically his whole life trying to figure out and describe Lyndon Johnson's greatness as a political figure, which was based on being Senate Majority Leader. And I guess Mitch grew up during that time. And for some reason or other, maybe it was that, decided he wanted to be majority leader and be like Lyndon Johnson or the Lyndon Johnson of the Republican Party or something. I don't know what. He's sort of actually the anti-Lyndon Johnson in the sense that LBJ built up the Great Society and pushed the Civil Rights Act and did as best he could domestically to make the government a force for good. Mitch is exactly the opposite. But he wants that power. So he would be utterly willing to go in and tell George Bush that, not because he cared about the war, Mitch McConnell, who, by the way, didn't have to go into Vietnam because of the...
He had a genuine 4F,
but it wasn't...
Good for him.
But interestingly, it wasn't coming through quite fast enough for him to get out of the training that he was in, so he could pursue his legal career and then his political career. So he got John Sherman Cooper to Senator John Sherman Cooper,
who he worked for,
and who was one of his idols, to get him out. But in any case, Mitch McConnell didn't care about that, about what was actually happening in Iraq.
You can't get a pass on polio, but bone spurs or whatever the crap. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Now I have some sympathy.
Yeah. All right. But
a molecule.
All right. The point is that I think it's interesting that George W. Bush saw that for what it was, which was just an utterly craven political ploy.
Yeah.
And even George Bush was too much for George W. Bush, who was not above some of that himself. Put it in his autobiography. I thought that's very interesting and damning of Mitch McConnell.
So Mitch McConnell, I got on the bad side of him once, and
you don't say.
Yeah, Elena Kagan was our nominee. We were about to have the vote on her, and he was, I believe, the second to last speech, and Harry Reid was the last one. So he gave this speech that was unbelievably condescending to her.
No one has any doubt that Ms. Kagan is bright and personable and easy to get along with, but the Supreme Court is not a dinner club. If getting along in polite society were enough to put somebody on the Supreme Court, then we wouldn't need confirmation hearings at all. The goal here is not to determine whether we think someone will get along well with the other eight justices.
Okay.
It's a pretty weak argument.
Well, I mean, imagine that you're saying, you know, no one has any doubt that Neil Gorsuch is bright and personable and easy on the eye. Uh-huh. I mean, this is so crazily sexist.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I start laughing. Mm-hmm. And I can't help myself because the whole speech is like this. And I'm presiding. I should make that clear. Uh-huh. I start laughing, and he's speaking to the
Mr. President, that's
you. Yeah, 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 that's me. And I'm just going like, I can't stop laughing. Now, this is what most people do when they're presiding. They read their press clipping. and I, because I was a performer, had been a performer, I listened to every speech. Yep. And I like gave eye contact to the speaker, and it was... To some of them, it was unnerving.
Yeah,
because no one had ever done that.
And were you looking at? were you looking at Mitch and laughing?
Yes. And that was a mistake, and I own it as a mistake. It's a mistake. You shouldn't do that.
Well, there's no greater wound to Mitch McConnell than when he's standing up there as a leader of the Senate. His lifelong dream to be taken seriously and not dismissed, but be admired and feared and respected, for somebody to laugh in his face.
Yeah, he got mad. Yeah. He got mad and he marched up there after he was done and he said, "This is not Saturday Night Live." And he said it loud enough for the presses right behind there. And, he said, "You do that next time, I'm going to call you out." And I knew right away that I'd fucked up. And I knew the press had heard it. So right away, right after that, I was presiding, so I had to stay. And we had the vote, and I announced that Kagan was the Supreme Court justice. Then I went to his office, you know, weren't there, and he wasn't there. So I left a note apologizing for myself and saying I'm sorry, you know. And then I went to my office and they said, "Holy shit, you know, the press had picked it up." And so he accepted my apology. So that was
personally, I mean, was it?
No. we were about to go on a break, so I will say that we just didn't see each other. But his press secretary issued something like this, Senator Franken's apology is an appropriate response or something like that.
Yeah. So after he got over his fury, then he had you.
Yeah. But he let me off.
No, I know. I know. But then he really had you.
Oh, I see. I see. Damn, I'm dumb.
Knowing him, that's the thing that just drives him nuts. He doesn't care if he's hated. He expects to be hated. But he expects somehow that will produce, however reluctantly, in other people,
respect. Let's go to President Obama gets elected, and he says... The single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president.
That wasn't said on election night.
Right.
Although he supposedly might have said that privately to people, because what he was doing on what they did immediately upon election of Obama was McConnell gathered together the troops and they began trying to figure out how they were going to fight him from the start.
Because basically, when I came, we had 60 votes.
Right.
Because Arlen Specter switched.
Right.
But they were going to delay. They started using the filibuster.
Right. He eventually did say, I think he said in early 2010, our main objective is to make him one-term president. But the point is, from the very beginning, the idea was never, never. And what a quaint notion it now seems in our politics. for the opposition party to say, you know, let's give the guy a little time. Let's see where we can work together to start.
That's, of course, what we always do, Democrats.
No, the Democrats don't do that either.
Oh, not anymore.
Not anymore.
That's right, because when Trump, but it was Trump. That's not like a real test.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't...
Well,
can you believe that? When Trump came in,
yeah,
the Democrats said, oh, my God. You know, let's... But I think that we would have worked with him if he had had something to work with.
Right. And if he had any interest in playing ball that way. But the fact is, in a way, Mitch McConnell prepared the ground for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell's rejection of the idea of cooperation, which you're talking about now with regard to Obama, the sort of wholesale rejection of the system in a way. I mean, to say that you're not going to work with the president is to violate the spirit and in many ways the letter of the Constitution. And McConnell was perfectly willing to do that, eager to do it, to destroy the relationship between the presidency and the Congress, to undercut to the extent that he could the legitimacy of the president of the United States.
You know, one thing he did that I haven't heard other people talk about. This is something I would go to the AIPAC dinner, and almost every member of Congress would go to it, and it was this bipartisan thing, right? Before the 2012 election, McConnell gets up, and for the first time I've ever heard, he gives a rabidly partisan speech. Basically saying Republicans are the friends of Israel and Obama and the Democrats are, you know, its enemies. And I walked out and I didn't see anyone else walk out, but I walked out because the biggest strategic advantage, geopolitical advantage Israel had was this bipartisan support that we had been totally bipartisan in support of Israel until that moment.
And the reason for that is, so Mitch McConnell is undercutting Israel, is what you're saying, which he is.
For some political advantage,
right.
he's saying...
He's politicized the whole thing. And the reason is, by that point, Barack Obama had disagreements with Netanyahu, and the Democrats were beginning, you saw the slivers of division in the Democratic Party. And Mitch McConnell saw an avenue to exploit those divisions. So suddenly something he basically didn't care much about, it was just a box he was going to check off like every other, became a strategic weapon.
Also Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah. And the money. Yes.
The money.
And the money. And, but more than the money, because they get money lots of places. They frankly don't necessarily need Sheldon Adelson for the money. It's the division of the Democratic Party that they're looking at. That they're trying to exploit.
And I think he has really done that.
Sure, and he's done it, and it's to the long range. If you care about Israel's existence, it's a long range threat. It's now a real threat to Israel because it has become political.
I put that at his feet. And he knows that. Anyway, okay, then we get Scalia dying.
Right.
Okay, and Merrick Garland. And my God.
Well, there's a new book out that I read in preparation for this called Confirmation Bias. It's by Carl Hulse, who's a New York Times, very good New York Times reporter who's covered the Hill for a long time and has covered McConnell for a long time and covered the confirmation hearings for a long time. And he lays out in detail, as did an earlier piece in the New York Times, just how McConnell, within minutes of the death of Scalia, was already setting in stone the strategy of Republican refusal, wholesale Republican refusal to consider a replacement during the last year of Obama's term. And McConnell did that. He realized that it was important that he instantly, like they were still, you know, carting poor old Scalia's body out of the lodge in West Texas. When McConnell was on the phone with people saying, we've got to immediately say, and I am going to immediately say, I'm not going to consult with the Republican caucus. I'm going to immediately say and put it out publicly that as Republican leader, we are not going, as majority leader, we are not going to consider a replacement for Scalia in the last year of the Obama term. We'll wait till the next president.
Biden rule.
Yeah, and we're going to do it. Yes, Biden. We're gonna do it. And he wanted to get out ahead of Ted Cruz, who he was afraid would make an issue out of it, and it would be identified with Cruz, who everybody hated, and not with McConnell, who everybody hated but also feared. And so he did that. And it was because of McConnell's move, entirely because of that instant decision within an hour of the death of Scalia to put out that public statement, that the result was that Garland never got a hearing.
And I was on Judiciary, and the Republicans on Judiciary kept saying, it's the Biden rule. And that was complete bullshit.
Yes.
Because what Biden had given this speech, but it was at the end of a session, like in June of before an election. And he was saying, if one of these guys retire, then we're not going to confirm somebody unless, and he said, unless it's a moderate. Mm-hmm. And he said, unless we're consulted.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm not sure what would have happened to Garland. I think it was outrageous, but that's Mitch McConnell. And it was what he realized that was so clever.
I think what would have happened with Garland is that he would have been confirmed because, mm-hmm. and I think that's why he didn't want hearings, is because Merrick Garland is brilliant and unbelievably, he was a consensus builder on the circuit.
Yeah, that's very possible. But my point about McConnell is he's so cunning in the destruction of institutions to serve his own purposes. In other words, the caucus, in theory, the party caucuses are still supposed to be a big thing to some people. But Mitch totally ignored the caucus in order to issue that public edict, which ended up working. And then after that, he was instrumental in coming up with the list of...
The Federalist Society
list. He works very closely with Leonard Leo and all those people to put together the list. And he argues, McConnell argues, that it was because of the list, which he claims credit for, which actually was Don McGahn's idea, but it doesn't matter, that got Trump elected.
Yeah, and it was. Because basically, Trump, yeah, that's how he got the evangelical community. That's why
they didn't trust him, but they said, look, here's this list.
Well, and it's the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, right?
Right.
Anyway,
and he's picked people from that list, and basically turned over the entire nomination process to Leo in the Federalist Society.
Yeah, brilliant move.
He didn't want, because he didn't think he could win, and maybe even because he found him not only repulsive but. Was worried that he couldn't control him. He was against Trump during the Republican primaries. He was almost part of the never Trump thing. He didn't quite get there, which is typical McConnell, but he would have preferred almost any other candidate to Donald Trump. But then when he saw that Trump was actually going to win the nomination, he completely shifted. I remember him talking about how we can drop him like a hot rock, meaning Trump. Mitch embraced the hot rock, and he also learned not to be offended by Trump's style, and in fact to talk to Trump all the time. He talks to Trump constantly because Trump loves phone, and he instructs Trump in some of the mysteries of the Senate and makes Trump feel like he knows what's going on. It's hard to overstate how much power Mitch McConnell now has. I mean, he's right up there with the president. Certainly in terms of the judiciary, McConnell basically runs it. He basically runs it.
Well, McGahn, of course.
Did.
White House counsel. So, I want to go back to the ACA,
mm-hmm.
just quickly, and then go to repeal and replace. Okay. I remember that. Remember Max Baucus
yes.
from Montana was trying to put together a bipartisan
yes, I recall
health care plan, and he had Grassley, Enzi, and Olympia Snow that he was working with, and this went on for months. And we would have a caucus lunch. Max would make a report, and we're not there yet. And finally, after 3 months of this or 4 months of this, he goes, well, it's falling apart, and it's not going to happen. We're just not going to get a bipartisan agreement. Arlen Specter says, I could have told you that. And I say, then why didn't you? I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Like, Arlen... And so,
well, for every conceivable reason under the sun, Mitch McConnell wanted to kill that thing and prevent it
and stop it in every conceivable way. It's a
for
plan.
Every conceivable reason.
Yeah, it's a plan actually put together by the Heritage Foundation.
Right. Well, first, all senators, especially ones who've served for a long time, many of them, not all, but many have to account for previous things they said. And part of Joe Biden's problem running for president is there are lots of Biden rules out there that people can twist and turn around based on what he said over such a long career. And Biden cares about that. He cares about trying to be consistent, even if he isn't. McConnell doesn't care. You can say to him, hey, you know, you protested what Harry Reid did with the nuclear option on the judges, and now you're doing it on even worse than he did. McConnell's not going to buy it. He will not. He's impervious to this.
He's going to say we're doing it because Harry did it,
right? But where he can, he will blame the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Where he can't blame the other side, he'll just say nothing. He'll just say we have the right to do it.
Okay, so now let's go to repeal and replace. Let's rush ahead.
Yeah,
they win in 16. They have everything. They have the House, the Senate, and they have the presidency. And suddenly, 8 years of saying we're going to repeal and replace, everybody's going like, okay, 8 years you've had. Let's see it. What do you got? It turned out they hadn't done anything.
No. To quote Arlen Specter, I could have told you that.
And so Mitch... puts 12 men,
mm-hmm.
12 white men in a room.
Yeah.
To come up with something. And what they come up with is like 22 million people will lose their insurance. Medicaid will be slashed. So people in rural, you know,
mm-hmm.
people will no longer, rural hospitals. I did a tour in Minnesota of rural hospitals during that time after he released that plan. Rural hospitals were doing great because they had expanded Medicaid, and that meant there was less uncompensated care. So people now who went into emergency room, Medicaid paid for it. So the hospitals had a lot of money. Yeah. They had more money, so they could hire more technicians more doctors,
mm-hmm.
and they could nurses and housekeepers, and the food was better. I went to a rural town in Minnesota where the best restaurant in town was the hospital cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
People would go out to dinner at the, you know, they got a great lasagna there, you know, and people, they had expanded care. People were freaked out at what they did, and yet he almost got it done.
It's interesting. I think that was a miscalculation by him, and it didn't cost him the Senate, but it cost him arguably it cost him the House. And that was a rare miscalculation from the narrow perspective of accumulating power. But don't forget, McConnell... back in Kentucky, meanwhile, the trends that he set in motion were beginning or threatening to engulf him, because the Tea Party is the natural conclusion, a natural product of McConnell's kind of politics as they evolved. They saw him as the establishment guy. Suddenly, the way he'd gone and accumulated power in Washington was something of a threat to him. And a guy came up to run against him in the primary, Matt Bevin, who is now the governor, who seriously challenged him from the, I wouldn't say necessarily from the right, but from the populist anti-establishment perspective. So Mitch probably engaged in that risky exercise partly to defend himself, and it kind of backfired. I think he's now tamed those people. He's now so close to Trump. He's inseparable from Trump, that will protect Mitch in Kentucky, where he's up again this time, but you have to pitch a totally perfect game to even have a shot at beating him. And he's going to be...
It's a Republican state.
It's a totally Republican state now, and he'll hope to continue putting judges in the courts, and I don't know what else. His ultimate hope is for somebody to acknowledge him as a master. Somebody credible. Yes, somebody credible.
Let's play a joke on him. Let's get Caro
to call him up and
to
say,
call him up and said, you know what? I'm canceling the last book. The last volume on Johnson, because one, I'm sick of doing Johnson.
Yeah, I just had enough.
And two,
you're the anti-master. You're the destroyer of the Senate.
I've been watching you, and I respect how awful you are.
What's more interesting, building or destroying?
Any child knows that destroying.
Yeah.
There you go.
I know a bunch of these popular historians. Maybe I'll convince my friend Meacham to do it, John Meacham to do it.
Oh, just as a joke.
Joke's a joke. First, I have to make sure that...
We finally came up with a good idea here on the show.
Yeah, I have to make sure that John Meacham knows it's a joke.
Yeah.
I think he will.
Yeah. Howard, thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
I hope you had fun.
I had a great time.
Good. Howard Fineman. Howard Fineman. Pundit extraordinaire. See you next time here on the Al Franken Podcast.